Our hyper-accelerated world makes increasing demands on our time, and it seems like the only option is to opt out or burn out. But freedom won't be found by desperately searching for some breathing space within the maelstrom. Only a struggle over how we spend our time will liberate us. At least, that's the argument of my guest this week.
I'm Alex Hochuli. I'm a podcaster, writer, and consultant based in São Paulo, Brazil. But I'm also the host and one of the producers of BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history, as we like to say.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining me. And I'm a big fan of the podcast. I really enjoy it. I really wanted to talk to you about ideas of modernity and what the heck is going on, you know, that's hyper everything. Or is it? Is it hyper everything? So you wrote this article for Damage Mag where you say that people are increasingly looking for an escape from our hyper accelerated world. Can you tell me a little bit about this culture of hyper acceleration, but also exhaustion and withdrawal? What are you trying to get at with those themes?
Right. So, I mean, I guess like all pieces like this of maybe social theory or some kind of social observation, social criticism, it starts from some sort of intuition that something's going on in society, I guess, right? And mine was that after the decade of populist decade, the 2010s and kind of return of politics, all the excitement around, particularly on the left, around left populism, around the campaigns of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn and others, you know, elsewhere across Europe, that there was a sense of exhaustion. And I'd read a couple of other things here and there testifying to a similar phenomenon, not kind of biographically saying, you know, I'm feeling exhausted, but more generally observing the sense that there is an element of exhaustion, disengagement, and withdrawal, which runs contrary to what had occurred over the past couple of years, even maybe decade or more of continual engagement, right? And like, it's worth considering, I guess, for a second, what we mean by engagement, because it's a term which is bandied about. It's something that in the attention economy is, you know, the crucial sort of asset. And it's something that institutions, elite institutions, all sorts of institutions kind of go after. They want people to engage, right? In part because there has been a kind of process of deinstitutionalization that people don't belong to civic associations, political parties, etc. And that process of itemization has meant institutions often feel like there's this echo when they talk to people, right? So they want people to engage, constantly wanting to engage. But of course, institutions only want people to engage on their own terms. And that has this funny blowback effect. So the most typical phenomenon is the get out the vote campaigns, which were, you know, kind of par for the course for all mainstream parties through the 90s, 2000s into the 2010s. But then this particularly the 2010s, where you get increasing frequency, increasing an intensity of, you know, populist insurrections at the ballot box and on the streets, these political parties tend to go, well, actually, and not like that. We wanted you to vote, but not like that, right? And Brexit or Trump is, you know, kind of perfect examples of that. But other insurrections, you know, the Bernie Sanders one from the perspective of establishment Democrats, similar sort of story there.
Let's indulge in some nostalgia for a moment. It's the 1990s, and political apathy is the complaint on every politician's lips. Trump is discussed less for his political affairs than the extramarital ones. The end of the Soviet Union is in recent memory, and American-style democracy emerges triumphant, with the average voter annoyed and bored with the whole charade. Academics write articles with the lack of vibrant public debate. The Times Mirror, a major newspaper publisher, releases a study dubbing the era the Age of Indifference. Ah, the good old days. Well, they were if you were a policymaker back then. After 2016, politics seemed alive again. But that's not what they meant when they complained about political apathy. They meant they wanted people to at least look enthused while they gave passive assent to a course long ago decided. not a world in which the deplorables actually thought they had a say in politics. They long for a return to that comfortable political indifference that reigned three short decades ago, when getting people excited about politics meant a rock the vote talk at a local high school. They want that comfortable indifference where you can think up some intervention and measure it and write it up in a promotion application or a PowerPoint presentation where people are grateful recipients or dealers of your charitable interventions. But they won't get that. There's no going back. Political frustrations reappear elsewhere. Yes, in conspiracies, in populist figures who promise to tell it like it is. In the face of this, policymakers know that we will be engaged. They want us to be engaged, but they want us to engage on their terms.
There is this constant kind of demand for engagement from the top down, which has a kind of sinister aspect in terms of trying to manage people in a certain way. But also on social media, right? We're constantly called upon to engage. And this constant engagement, this sense of being always on, which is very closely related to smartphones, social media, the internet, the kind of one critic that I cite in the essay, Julian Crary, calls kind of the 24/7 society or something like that. And so that can breed a sense of exhaustion if it doesn't really go anywhere, right? You're constantly meant to be kind of hyped up, turned on, engaged, switched in, you know, et cetera. And I got the sense that people were, after the sort of long populist decade of the 2010s, both disengaging politically, and there's indices of this. There's a piece by Ryan Zitgraff in Compact, which I think I cite, and you know he looks at a couple of indices of, you know, people sharing news less, people making fewer donations to politicians, campaigns. You know, turnout is maybe a difficult metric because it's so dependent on the particular rhythms of the electoral calendar. But in general, all those indices of kind of greater of a return to politics seem to be kind of ebbing away after having kind of returned again over the course of the past decade. So that was the kind of, that's the intuition where from which I started, that at least at a political level and maybe at a kind of social sub-political level, there's a sense of exhaustion and withdrawal.
Yeah, so there was this sense of like, oh gosh, wow, we've got the internet and everything seems so alive and politics is back, you know, politics is back. This is going to be great. And then all of a sudden, and you kind of compare, in fact, you use Zitgraff to kind of compare it to like the excitement of the 60s, right? There's like this rejuvenation of politics and that sort of thing. And then you have the exhaustion of the 70s. This is kind of what's happening now, that we could see sort of Me Too decade. We retreat into a kind of politics as self-care.
Yeah, I mean, that's Ryan. That's from Ryan's piece. But yeah, I mean, there's an appealing nature to that analogy, right, with the 70s, the 60s into the 70s. But there's so much that's different. It's probably not worth dwelling on too much. The only comparison that I would make is that the kind of the millennials had their own moment of sort of finding themselves and falling in love with themselves, right? So the boomers classically as it almost set the pattern for what the cult of youth was to become, the notion that youth has some meaning and some importance. And, you know, in that case, there was like an obvious reason for that. It was a very large generation which had grown up into a world in which there were increasing consumer goods, some sense of popular affluence, pretty radically different from the pre-war, pre-Second World War era. And also, you know, a generation which felt they weren't tainted by what had happened before, right? And, you know, this is particularly acute in Germany, obviously. But you know, something which happened, it was a phenomenon kind of across the Western world of this sort of youth revolt. And the boomers all fell in love with themselves and they're still in love with themselves. And that's a discussion for another time. But the millennials, you know, us, I guess, also had a moment of falling in love with ourselves, and our moment of self-enamoration was with, you know, Facebook revolution, the Arab Spring, the occupation of the squares, the sense that we could do politics through these new technologies that would liberate us, that would bring us together in ways that were, you know, unthought of before, that we wouldn't need the old traditional structures of political parties, of trade unions, of other organizations, like, you know, on a face-to-face basis, we could literally create an event on Facebook and revolution would happen. And we wouldn't really have to reckon with power. And this was I think the product of a generation which had been, had kind of undergone a kind of scission vis-a-vis previous generations, precisely because of the end of history, right? That it that we millennials had been brought up in an era in which we didn't really have to reckon with the difficulties of power, because politics was something that was to be relegated to the back, you know, the sort of back rooms where politicians congregate, to technocratic, technocratic institutions, to quangos, etc. And so politics was something that didn't really matter. You know, you could dedicate yourself to kind of your sub-political pursuits, which, you know, you could dress up as being politics, you know, you could do kind of radical art or whatever. But basically, there was no politics. And suddenly, dealing with the effects, the delayed effects of the global financial crisis with austerity politics, etc., kind of repoliticizes society in a certain way. But a generation which hadn't been really, formed in a way which to know what power was, the difficulties of it, have failed. It kind of disconnected from the experiences even of the boomers by Gen X, who had been who are the example of a generation of kind of withdrawal, disengagement, depoliticization. It was kind of being like thrown into the world like a baby, right, and not knowing how to deal with it. So I think that's a little bit kind of how we found ourselves, and then we have this moment of, you know, the Facebook revolution. We fall in love with ourselves.
And now we are in the kind of a moment of or going into a moment perhaps of withdrawal.
Right. So this is to continue on the kind of analogy, such as it is with the 1960s, is that we fall in love with ourselves. We're disillusioned by it. We don't put up any new organizations, right? I mean, you know, to pick the most important political example globally, I think, in terms of the past decade with regard to the left, which was the Bernie Sanders campaign, that doesn't birth any new organization, right? For all the emails collected and the donations made, our revolution, et cetera, is not spun off into a new party, which is, I think, the only kind of would have been the only like legitimate move to make at that point, right? So we're kind of left with nothing after all this excitement, this return of politics, this belief that actually, no way, we might change the world, because when we were growing up, you know, our teachers and parents and whatever told us, oh, you're special and you're going to change the world and all this kind of stuff. You can be yourself. You can find yourself and change the world. You can do good and be successful. All these kind of mantras that kind of particularly millennials grew up with, suddenly seem to actually not be true. And there's a kind of bitterness that ensues from that. So it's not just a generational effect, though, what I'm talking about, right? Because I think that politicization, sure, the kind of leading edge of that, the people who were kind of most swept up in it were millennials, probably the kind of older cohort of millennials, which is to say us. And that certainly has gives the whole kind of historical moment its complexion. But the fact that I try to tie that into is that it's not just an exhaustion after a whole lot of what Anton Yeager calls hyperpolitics, what I've called the politics of the apeiron, in an essay for Sublation from a couple of years back. So you have this hyperpoliticization where politics becomes everywhere and nowhere at the same time, where, you know, who you vote for becomes a subject of rancorous debate at the dinner table. Again, that's sort of another way in which the recent moment is comparable to the 1960s. So I always like to refer to the Philip Roth novel, American Pastoral.
American Pastoral by Philip Roth, or Deja Vu. It was during the Vietnam War that Lew Levov had begun mailing Mary copies of the letters he sent to President Johnson, letters that he had written to influence Mary's behavior more than the president's. Seeing his teenage granddaughter as enraged with the war as he could get when things started to go too wrong with the business, the old man became so distressed that he would take his son aside and say, "Why does she care? Where does she even get this stuff? Who feeds it to her? What's the difference to her anyway? Does she carry on like this at school? She can't do this at school. She could harm her chances at school. She can harm her chances for college. In public, people won't put up with it. They'll chop her head off. She's only a child." To control, if he could, not so much Mary's opinions as the ferocity with which she sputtered them out, he would ostentatiously ally himself with her by sending articles clipped from the Florida papers and inscribed in the margins with his own anti-war slogans. When he was visiting, he would read aloud to her from the portfolio of his Johnson letters that he carried around the house under his arm, in his effort to save her from herself, tagging after the child as though he were the child. "We've got to nip this in the bud," he confided to his son. "This won't do, not at all." "Well," he'd say, after reading to Mary yet another plea to the president reminding him what a great country America was, what a great president FDR had been, how much his own family owed to this country, and what a personal disappointment it was to him and his loved ones that American boys were halfway around the world fighting somebody else's battle when they ought to be at home with their loved ones. "Well, what do you think of your grandfather?" "Johnson's a war criminal," she'd say. "He's not going to stop the war, Grandpa, because you tell him to. He's also a man trying to do his job, you know. He's an imperialist dog." "Well, that is one opinion. There's no difference between him and Hitler." "You're exaggerating, sweetheart. I don't say Johnson didn't let us down, but you forget what Hitler did to the Jews, Mary dear. You weren't born then, so you don't remember. He did nothing that Johnson isn't doing to the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese aren't being put into concentration camps. Vietnam is one big camp. The American boys aren't the issue. That's like saying, get the stormtroopers out of Auschwitz in time for Christmas. I gotta be political with the guy, sweetheart. I can't write the guy and call him a murderer and expect that he's going to listen. Right, Seymour?" "I don't think that would help," Swede said. "Mary, we all feel the way you do," her grandfather told her. "Do you understand that? Believe me, I know what it is to read the newspaper and start to go nuts."
Where a kind of a well-to-do middle-class family is, you know, kind of confronted with their daughter rebelling seemingly over nothing. And, you know, these become very, you know, bitter debates in the kind of dinner table. And you kind of have a repeat of that in the current age, you know, where everything becomes about, you know, Trump, MAGA or wokeness or whatever, right? And so there's a seeming kind of sense that politics is everywhere, but at the same time, it's completely deinstitutionalized and disconnected. And there's no traction really between debating stuff online, sharing a news article to prove to your aunt that the world is, you know, see all these bad things are happening or whatever it might be. And policy change at the end of the road. There is no connection to that. There's no institution building, right? And so there's that happens at a political level. Both my intuition and also kind of the philosophers and theorists that I draw upon make an argument that this sense of hyperactivity, I guess, inheres in kind of the social life at a more general and intimate way than merely in quotation marks, and merely with regard to politics.
So this is kind of what you call in the article hyperpolitics, the sort of section is called "Hyperpolitics is Driving Us Crazy," where all sorts of things become politicized, where, you know, you thought you were just things that shouldn't be politicized become politicized. You thought you were just engaging in a hobby or watching a cooking show or knitting, but it turns out that that hobby and that cooking show and that knitting were actually the new pathways being traversed by white supremacy. And if you were not aware of it, you know, you were complicit. And so all of this politics started to bleed out into everything. But at the same time, I like the image that you give in the article. You talk about like it needs a container. We have this very fluid politics where it just sort of bleeds out into everything. As you were saying, it's like at the dinner table, but it needs a container. But that wasn't produced. There's no party. There's no participation, which is part of society, as you say in the article. But I remember years ago, actually, you were interviewing me for your podcast, and you asked a question that I had never forgotten. You said, well, maybe this is just the way people are now. You know, because I was railing against self-obsession and mental health as politics, and I was explaining why this was a dead end. And he said, well, maybe this is just the way people are now. Maybe you have to engage with people as they are. And I think about that all the time. So I want to ask you, maybe this is just the way people are now. I interviewed Tamandra Harkness last week, and her book, Technology is Not the Problem, talks about mass production. The era of mass production brought us all into workplaces en masse, right? And this produced the era of mass politics and mass movements. And now we have an era of atomization, mass customization. You talk about in the article the self being a new area to be exploited by capitalism. Our sort of internal worlds become this new kind of raw material. The kind of politics that is produced by that is not going to be mass in the same ways. So mass production produces mass politics. Mass customization and atomization produces, you know, what? Maybe that's just kind of where we are now. I don't know the way out of that.
I think that's true. And I mean, simply yearning for a return or even fighting for a return of mass politics as we knew it, I'm pretty sure would be wrong. Just because these are, you know, kind of mass politics was phenomenal. And, you know, it kind of, it was a reflection of deeper or ways that the economy is organized, as you were referring to, in terms of, you know, mass production of people lumped together in a big factory, right? And then they can meet each other and then form a political party. And the conditions are gone, even if we would like to recreate it. And I would think recreating would be a good thing. But I think we obviously have to adapt our politics to a new era, or rather, you know, to the extent, you know, there really isn't politics as we know it. So we need to find the basis for recreating politics, actually. And I think, you know, so on one level, yes, you have to kind of, you know, play the field as you find it, and not pretend that you're in, you know, 1910 or 1920. But there is, I think, there what the kind of current age produces and kind of relies upon is mood, right? And mood is often talked about in relation to finance, right? Bear markets, bull markets, etc. And we live in a society of speculation, of financialization, where these very fast flows kind of come to set the tempo for life. It sets a tempo for politics. It sets a tempo for institutions like the judiciary. It sets a tempo for, you know, consumer markets. It sets a tempo kind of for everything, right? Kind of on-demand, instant, frictionless, incredibly convenient for the consumer, at least, right? Not the one who maybe has to deliver, but the consumer. And the problem is, I think that is exhausting, right? Because there's this reliance on mood, which I think. So if we think about the way that mood functions, when you have no, like, let's talk about politics specifically, right? To refer to what you pulled out from my article about containers. Right. When you are a member of an organization, you know, a political party, and you have to go to local branch meetings, things are kind of routinized and bureaucratized to a certain degree, to a certain useful degree, that you don't need to turn up and be a self-starter, you know, to use the kind of neoliberal jargon of the era, managerial jargon of the era. You just go about and you attend the meetings and you might have your job to do. And it's kind of routinized and you don't need to necessarily give it your all. Or you know, worry if you're a little bit slower that day. You know, things are kind of set in pace, and that in part because the institution is able to absorb a lot of that, like energy regulation. Now, that isn't to say that morale isn't important. Morale is always important in organizations, but to a certain extent, it's outsourced. It's put the responsibility for it is kind of at an institutional level, not you as an individual. Now, the problem with a lot of recent political campaigns, we can think about left populism because it's the example we probably both have in mind, and your listeners might have in mind as well, that it was a lot of frenetic activity behind this campaign, which was incredibly dependent on media, on social media to get the word out, on getting on mainstream media to project this idea, because it was all hope and expectation rested in the individual. And most, you know, particularly in the case of Corbyn and of Bernie Sanders, maybe a little bit less so in the case of Syriza and Greece, but still quite a lot in the case of Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France, right? These are all cases where you have what the Italian sociologist Paolo Gerbaldo calls the hyperleader, right? Where the hyperleader comes to embody all the hopes and expectations and vision and politics, which used to inhere in the political party. Instead, it's all in this one person. Anyway, that situation, that configuration of politics relies on a hell of a lot of energy from campaigners to go get the vote out and be driven by that electoral cycle, because the whole left populist moment, let's remember, was driven by a sort of gamble. It was the, like, let's get executive power immediately. Let's elect a president of the United States. We don't have an organization. We don't have a kind of new political party. We're just going to make a quick jump, reach for executive power, even in many cases against the political party, which was definitely the case in the UK and the US. You know, in Greece, it was a new party which formed, but had to really come to power as a kind of very much an insurgent. So it's again, this all rests on a lot of vibes, right? On hype, on mood. And the problem with hype and mood and all the rest of it is that, you know, if it doesn't have a container like a political party to kind of drip feed it and sustain it, where you rely on one another to kind of just keep plodding to a certain extent, right? It's a kind of much more mechanistic and slow-paced vision of politics than the contemporary one based on social media, on engagement, on attention, on getting out the vote, making that quick grab for power, right? So the more traditional pace setting of politics, you know, relies on institutions to do that. Without those institutions, we're all just kind of free-floating and we rely exceptionally on mood, right? Everyone's hyped up, everyone sees possibility, everyone's excited about Gaza now and trying to stop that. And then at a certain point, you know, Israel's offensive will kind of reduce and it'll die off and attention will go elsewhere. And then people who have been camped out in, you know, elite university forecourts and lawns and whatever will go back to what they were doing and kind of feel demoralized and exhausted, or maybe have a brief moment of feeling like they did something or did the right thing, but will feel exhausted because there's no way of giving continuity to that politics, right? So that's what I guess I'm getting at with the point about containers. And it's worth making a reference and highlighting the fact that my essay comes out in the second issue of Damage magazine, where I'm part of the editorial group. And it's an issue called Deinstitutionalized, right? Which starts on the premise about the anti-psychiatric kind of revolution of the 70s of getting people out of insane asylums, which are awful places, and supposedly having care in the community, but ultimately leaving a lot of people with very severe mental health issues on the streets without families to care for them, et cetera, expecting that the community would care for them, but actually greatly increasing homelessness and these broad and these kind of social problems, which kind of no one has real responsibility for. But that works as a sort of metaphor for a broader phenomenon in which, unlike the old kind of disciplinary institutions that Foucault critiqued, you know, of the kind of mid-20th century, we're in this hyper-modern period where we are deinstitutionalized, where we're kind of all kind of these atoms floating about, having to be self-starters, being an Uber driver connected to the company only via an app, for example, rather than being in a factory where you turn up every day and you clock in and you clock out and you have a formal relationship with the company as an employee.
See, now this reminds me a lot of the sort of critiques of neoliberalism when it comes to mental health discourses and the sort of side disciplines, that sort of thing, that you are expected to be a self-starter, that you are expected to engage in, you know, rituals of self-care but all of these are disciplinary methods that have moved out of the institution into the community and into your head, really. And people will often say, this is an attempt, this policy is an attempt to create an ideal neoliberal subject who will be autonomous, who will do this and that. And then when I look at the discourses, I think, where is this autonomous subject that's being built here? And first of all, why do they think they need to build these autonomous subjects in the first place, right? Like it starts with an assumption that you don't actually have that capability. But these discourses, at least the ones that I study, I don't want to plug my book constantly, but in my new book and in my previous book, they begin explicitly with a campaign to disempower people. You thought that you knew how to self-manage. You thought that you were just fine in this particular area. But did you know that actually scientists say you're not as happy as you should be, that you are pursuing happiness in all the wrong ways? You didn't know that you had this problem, and I'm here to tell you that you do. And so I think there's a contradiction here, and you touch on it a little bit in this piece, between this these contradictory messages around autonomy. So as you say, you're supposed to be a self-starter, right? But at the same time, there's a profound doubt that you are. So you got to have this app on your phone and during your free time, you should engage in meditation that will stop you from your intrusive thoughts. You should recognize that your inability to focus on your banal task when there's a whole world of internet excitement next just one click away, is actually a form of ADHD. You should recognize this, realize that you are actually defective, and you should seek out the appropriate forms of help. You should not be autonomous. Your autonomy is a risk. You should be heteronomous. You should recognize your will must be shaped by another, by technology, you know, be that like an app or like a discourse or something like that. So could you tell me like a little bit more about this contradiction of modernity and autonomy and heteronomy, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, that isn't something I guess I deal with directly in the article. I discuss how autonomy relates to acceleration, right? To things going ever faster, and how that used to hold a promise and seems no longer to. But I guess we'll come on to that in a second. I mean, the issue with autonomy, I think that the autonomous subject is a completely governed one where there's very little between the atomic individual and the state. And it's a subject meant to be self-regulated, which is meant to be kind of well-behaved and take responsibility for their life, right? In a kind of narrow sense, right? Because you're the one who has to go make a living for them, you know, for themselves, as a kind of entrepreneur, whatever, right? And the way that you're pushed to be an entrepreneur, and this happens within organizations as much as it does for, you know, the self-employed, that push for entrepreneurialism is basically a way of intensifying the working day. I mean, to be kind of really basic about it, that's what it's about. And to not have you think about kind of what you're doing with your time. It's to just kind of push you harder. Now, that, I guess, a thing which you're right at pointing to in terms of like, how do we mediate this idea that, in fact, we are not trusted to be autonomous, not trusted in many ways to be subjects who are capacious and are able to govern themselves, right? The kind of free autonomous individual is something that exists more in memory than in actuality. And at the same time, that there's this emphasis on autonomy. And I think there's a trick there, I think, for us to be able to explain out how those two things coexist when they seem to be opposed, right? They seem to run counter to each other. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, because they both do exist. I think we can't deny that there's like the both of these kind of rhetorics and discourses, but not just at the level of rhetoric and discourse, but in actuality, in terms of policy, in terms of government, and in terms of subjectivity, that these things do coexist. I think
you're right. I did say I wouldn't shamelessly plug my own book, but I actually did write about this in relation to Arianna Huffington. So here's an excerpt from my new book, Significant Emotions, which came out at the start of the year, page 93. Arianna Huffington's 2014 book, Thrive, in which she advocates mindfulness meditation, begins with an anecdote of a fall she suffers due to exhaustion from overwork. She writes, "In terms of the traditional measures of success, which focus on money and power, I was very successful, but I was not living a successful life by any sane definition." Later, she warns readers that studies have failed to find a consistent connection between money and happiness and exhorts them to move beyond the relentless competition to work harder, stay later, pull more all-nighters. Yet on her blog, she wrote, "There's nothing touchy-feely about increased profits. This is a tough economy, and it's going to be that way for a long time. Stress reduction and mindfulness don't just make us happier and healthier. They're a proven competitive advantage for any business that wants one." The connection between high pressure, long working hours, and profit appears to elude her. The desire for a bit of freedom and happiness turns in on itself and becomes another competitive advantage. Once again, the escape from calculation and competition itself becomes a business, and in so doing, duplicates all the evils it was meant to relieve. Side note, Arianna Huffington's wellness company became well known for being a ruthless place to work. I'm drawing on a point that I introduced earlier in the book. On page 39, I write, "This is evident in Marx's discussion of the way that capitalists themselves often feel this weight. He describes how the capitalist acts as capital personified, whose motivating force is not the acquisition and enjoyment of use values, but the acquisition and augmentation of exchange values. He is compelled by external laws to continue expanding his capital to preserve his existence as a capitalist.
as a mere function of capital, his own private consumption counts as a robbery committed against its accumulation. However, as capitalism develops, a certain amount of expenditure upon luxury becomes necessary, for instance, in the securing of additional credit. It is no longer a threat, and may even help to drive accumulation. The capitalist, formerly an ascetic, begins to be drawn towards sin, Marx writes. He wants to enjoy and consume some of his riches and is even able to look back on his miserly past with quaintness. Yet Marx points out, he is never fully able to enjoy his profligacy. It is always lurking behind it the most sordid avarice and the most anxious calculation, even though capitalism has developed to a point where it is more able to accommodate both. For the miser, pleasure was a distraction from accumulation. For the modern capitalist, accumulation, while it enables it, is a mere distraction from pleasure. Or to put it in more romantic terms, what really matters in life. He begins to eschew more money and searches for meaning and enjoyment. However, as Marshall Berman describes, this nascent desire for freedom and happiness quickly turns in on itself, is devoured, assimilated, and turned to the capitalist's own advantage. Where pleasure becomes a business, it must acquire up-to-date business methods, that is, must duplicate all the compulsive calculation, all the cutthroat competition, all the frenzied self-alienation it was meant to allay. Thus, all the obsessions and necessities of capitalist society to extend the working day, to push wages as far down as workers will accept, are reenacted beneath a facade of idyllic calm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the world of the kind of more of a subject which would recognize its dependency, of its kind of mutual dependency, was one actually which privileged autonomy more than our contemporary age does, right? Mm-hmm. The autonomy that we imagine is purely one of non-interference, right? Rather than one in which we might collectively liberate ourselves or even individually liberate yourselves and take responsibility kind of for your life in connection with others. That is a vision which kind of has very much kind of closed off. And I think that's quite interesting. And then, you know, that kind of already starts to relate to the questions of acceleration.
As I was going through the article, I was like, it was a lot of hyper. It's a lot of hyper. It's a lot of more of this is happening. And it's kind of become a theme, I think, in a lot of public discourse, the pace of change. Pace of change is accelerating. It's such a common thing to say. And I often think to myself, first of all, is the pace of change accelerating? And I think you do a good job in the article to kind of actually make a case for that instead of just assuming it, as a lot of people do. But, you know, moving from the rural world of dwindling feudalism into the factories, you know, the bosses had to deal with the fact people did not want to, you know, work those hours that they were working with no break, that sort of thing. There was a real problem with people adapting to the working day to begin with, like to the capitalist working day. And you'd say goodbye to your family, you never saw them again. You know, you go on a ship, that was it. Goodbye. Is the pace of change really that accelerated today as much as people say it is? Or is it that we have so many more expectations, that so much more of life is subject to, I like to use the phrase, key performance indicators. You know, everything's got a KPI now, and that there just wouldn't be enough time. That it's not just a time crunch, it's that there's a proliferation of expectations. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, the sense of not enough time is...
Do we really not have enough time? What about the anti-work movement? Does that offer us an escape? Find out in part two. Visit patreon.com/AshleyAFrawley, where you'll find a backlog of 40 to 50 episodes just like this, lectures, my writing, and more.